I must evacuate Boston. Again, Washington wrote home to his brother, "This remarkable interposition of providence is for some wise purpose. I have yet no doubt." In the summer of 1776, General Howe's retreated from Boston, and he went to New York. And there he had 15,000 men, 8 to 9 battleships. The United States had no ships at that time, and only about 8,000 men. The British just beat the living daylights out of the Continental Army. No contest whatsoever. With about 3,000 men left, Washington huddled up on Long Island. General Howe said, "I've got them this time. I'm going to sail 3 of my biggest ships up, and we're going to capture the whole kit and caboodle." If they did, the revolution would be over, and to quote General Howe, "I'll hang Washington by daylight." 3 of the most magnificent ships in the magnificent army of the world sailed up the East River. But suddenly, the wind shifted. Instead of going northeast, it went southwest. The ships sat in that river just as if they were anchored, and they could not move. The admiral said he'd never seen anything like that. General Howe said, "No problem. We'll go in the morning." Well, Washington knew the only way he could save his army was to escape. He had to get across that river from Long Island over to New Jersey, and he had to do it that night, and he knew that. But the same wind that stopped the British ships stopped Washington from putting those smaller boats in the water to ferry his men across. 11 o'clock that night, according to journals written, the wind stopped, and so did the rain. Washington immediately loaded up his artillery and what he had left of his army, crossed the East River, and escaped that night into New Jersey. He didn't know that there was a spy over there. She was a Tory. She was faithful to the British Empire. She sent one of her servants down immediately and said, "Run down and tell General Howe that the Americans are escaping, the wind has died down, the Americans are escaping across the river. Do so immediately." The servant left. A little ways, just outside of the headquarters of the British Army, she was stopped, the servant, by 2 guards, 2 sentinels. The problem was, the sentinels were Hessian. Hessian were German mercenaries. Hessians didn't understand one single word of English. They had no idea what this servant was talking about. So they put her under guard, took her into the British camp first thing in the morning. By that time, the colonials were long gone. Again, was that intervention, circumstance, or just a miracle? George Washington later wrote about that in one of his journals, that he attributed the safe retreat of this American army to the hand of God. If the wind, the rain, and the fog, our heavenly messenger, had not intervened, we would have all been captured. I probably would have been hung, and the revolution would have come to an early end. In December of 1776, with low morale, and only 3,000 troops left, George Washington decided to attack Trenton on Christmas Day. All his generals said, "You can't do that. It's impossible. There's no way." But if Washington did not get a victory, we would not have a country. And he prayed that night. And he said, "We are attacking." In the middle of a blizzard, many men with just rags wrapped on their feet marched out. They got on boats. You've all seen a picture of Washington standing up in a boat crossing the Delaware. That's probably not true either, but it's a beautiful picture. Washington wasn't the best general, but he was a better sailor, and you're not going to stand up in a boat crossing it. They had blocks of ice, in some journals claimed the size of coffins banging against those ships. But Washington had to get across, and he had to surprise the British and the Hessians at Trenton before daylight. By the time they got everybody up there, were getting them across that ice-encrusted river, they were 4 hours behind. He was going to lose that daylight surprise. Then he saw men in front of him, and he thought, oh, my God. But these men were Maryland militia. And they were a little upset because the British had attacked them the day before and killed one of their sentinels. So they attacked the British just a few hours before. Now Washington thought, it's over, because they know we're coming. What Washington did not know was they knew they were coming anyways. And when that little militia unit went in there and fired on the Hessians and the British, they thought that was the main attack. So what did they do? They celebrated Christmas and all got drunk. When Washington went in the morning, he was afraid they would see him. And again, as we well know in Buffalo, what happened? He knew where Trenton was, but the Hessians and the British didn't know where he was. A huge blizzard kicked up, and the wind came from the back of the Continental's army into the face of the British. It was an easy victory for General Washington and the Continental Army. They lost one man and completely destroyed the Hessians and the British. But General Cornwallis was only 12 miles away, just south of Princeton. And again, he was told, march on Washington. And he did. And right after Trenton, Cornwallis pushed Washington. And again, George Washington wasn't the best general. He found himself backed up against the river, a spot you don't want to be because you have no place to retreat. And again, Cornwallis did not attack that night. The roads were boggy, slimy with mud, he said. A huge rainstorm. I'll get them and all in the morning. Washington still knew he had to leave. So as the rain subsided, it turned to sleet. The sleet turned to snow turned to ice, and froze those slimy, boggy roads solid. Washington lit hundreds of campfires, so the British thought they were still there, marched around the flank of the British Army, come over in behind them on the next morning, and routed Cornwallis. Of that, George Washington wrote in his journal, I most devotedly congratulate my country and every well-wisher to this cause and on this single stroke of providence. Roger Sherman wrote, this is the Lord's doing and marvelous in our eyes. A few short years later, after many, many setbacks, Benedict Arnold decided he wasn't just getting enough recognition. And as the commander of West Point, was going to sell that command out to the British, equivalent to $1 million in today's money. General Washington was going to be at West Point at the same time. When he sent the maps down to the British agent was to board a ship just in the Hudson River, sail down, and bring up the British forces. But somewhere, somehow, without orders, out of the blue, on the other side of the Hudson River, a renegade artillery battery pulled their gun down to the shore and started firing on the British ship. It actually started to tear it up pretty bad. The British captain would have none of this. The people in the rowboat that were supposed to take General Andre back, who had the maps, weren't going to have any of this either. They're getting the heck out of here, and they left. They left Andre on the beach. sail back to their ship. The ship sailed down the Hudson River without the maps. Shortly after that, Andre was captured. They found the maps. He was hung. And General Washington was saved, and so was West Point. It was all laid out picture perfect. How could it possibly go wrong? And who in the heck was this small little group of artillerymen that fired on that British ship? Divine intervention, circumstances, a miracle. And finally, in Cowpens, South Carolina, in 1781, General Daniel Morgan defeated an advancing British force, again under General Cornwallis. General Clinton joined Cornwallis, and they chased the pesky rebels, the pesky Continental Army, out. And if we read what Cornwallis wrote in his battle reports, "I reached the Kanawha River only hours after the Americans had crossed, but a sudden storm made the river impassable. We nearly overtook the Americans at the Yadin River, but once again, floods flooded the river so we could not cross. Another flash flood blocked us at the Dan River. This allowed the Americans to cross into friendly territory." British General Henry Clinton described these events a little different way. He said, "Here, our Royal Army was again stopped by a sudden rise of the waters, which had only just fallen, a miracle to let the enemy over and leave us on the other side." George Washington wrote, "We have abundant reasons to thank Providence for its many favorable interpositions in our behalf. At times when it was my only dependence, for all other resources seemed to have failed us." Also, at the last battle, the French Navy joined the Americans, and just outside Chesapeake Bay, as the British were ready to resupply Cornwallis with men and ammunition, they ran into the French Navy. 22 British ships, 19 French ships. The French defeated that group, and the British fleet had to sail back to New York for repairs. They could not drop off the supplies. They could not drop off the men. Cornwallis knew that he had no choice but to try to escape on his own without the Navy or to simply surrender. So he tried to cross the York River that night. His first wave of boats went across. He sent his best men, his heaviest artillery over. The second wave went across, got halfway across, and suddenly a gale force wind hit, blew those ships and those men all over the York River. Now Cornwallis was done. His finest troops were on the opposite side of the river. His other troops were scattered up and down the river. And his worst troops, least amount, were with him. It wasn't shortly thereafter that he surrendered to General Washington. Where did that wind come up? And where did it die off? Divine intervention? Miracle? And where was the British fleet? It was getting repaired in New York. But a week before, they had all their repairs done, and they set off. And they would have been there in time to resupply Cornwallis, and it would have been a whole different story. The problem was, when the British fleet sailed out of New York Harbor, the two biggest, grandest, finest ships in the British Navy, commanded by the best admirals, ran into each other. They had to go back in, get refitted, resupplied. They were 1 week too late. In 1787, after the peace treaty was signed. It was a general feeling in the colonies that God had blessed the American effort for their independence, and that the hand of God had intervened again and again to guide events at this critical time. Benjamin Franklin, who was not an avid churchgoer, but a believer, commented to the Continental Congress, "I have lived, sir, a long time. The longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men." Moses warned the ancient Israelites, who had been supernaturally delivered from Egypt by God through a series of powerful miracles, "Take heed to yourself, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart, and teach them to your children and your grandchildren." Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 9. Decades later, Joshua reminded his generation of Israelites how God had fought their battles. Chapter 23, verses 2 and 3, established their nation in a promised land by halting the waters of the Jordan River and breaking down the walls of Jericho. Centuries later, the prophet Isaiah warned the backsliding nation of Israel to remember the former things of old and how God had intervened on its behalf to accomplish his purpose. These are the same warnings that we need to take heed of today in America. Because America is a chosen, just as Israel is. But God will only serve those who serve him. So we can't stand idly by and see our country torn apart. Remember these words that the prophet said to Israel, because they're the same words that they could be saying to us today in America. The prophet Daniel records the same message in Daniel 2, verse 21. God removes kings, rises up kings, and the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he wills. In closing, if I was going to show the great seal, there it is, perfect, thank you. Do you know where this is from? Obviously, no? You do. I bet you all do. You're just all bashful. It's a great seal. It was made during the Revolution in the 1700s, shortly after the Revolution, actually. And it's on a $1 bill. But do you know what it stands for? What's on it? And this will prove to you of God's love for America and of God's innovation. This is the will recall the religious mode of our revolutionary era. The Egyptian pyramid symbolizes strength. The Roman numerals underneath the pyramid, which is hard to see, are actually 1776. I will blister this Latin, but nobody probably knows Latin, so they won't know whether I'm pronouncing it right or not. But Norvis Ordo Sacrarum translates into a new age now begins. And the one on the top, Anuit Sipprisis, for better or worse, he has favored our undertakings. All of that. But the most important is the eye, because the eye in the triangle is the all-seeing providence. And that is what holds our future, the eye. Our founding fathers knew that, and now we too know that. That I, again, is all-seeing providence. Divine intervention, a miracle, or just a set of circumstances? I'll leave that question entirely up to you. Amen and amen.